Now try this. Is it recording?
Oh, you didn't push your button. Whoa.
I don't
blame him.
The meeting of the Joint Legislative Study Committee on the Division of Local School Administration Units will come to order. I'm Bill Brawley. I'll be chairing. Senator Curtis, our co-chair, is in attendance with us today. Our committee support is Lynn Taylor. We have Sergeants at Arms from the House, Reggie Sills, Thomas Terry, Joe Crook, and John Gilbert, and Senate Sergeants at Arms, Archie Smith and Terry Edmondson. We have staff, Kara McCraw, Brian Gwynn, Drupti Chohan, Samantha Yarborough, Matt Paget, Caroline Sorensen, Leslie Karkanawi, close enough, Eric Moore, Eric Naismith, and Jenna Calderoni. Our tracker is back from Real Facts NC. First item of business today is the approval of the minutes for March 13. Is there a motion? Motion by Representative Stevens, second by Representative Gill. So many in favor say aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Minutes are adopted. We have a short agenda, but I think fairly meaty today. We will have presentations. First, Dr. Kevin Bastian, Senior Research Associate and Associate Director for the Education Policy Initiative at Carolina, University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Okay.
Education Policy Initiative.
Okay. That sounds like a win. And we also have Dr. Eric Houck, Associate Professor of Educational Leadership and Policy, UNC Chapel Hill. Gentlemen, I will let y'all swap off for as y'all see fit, but you are recognized for your presentation. Thank you for joining us today.
Oh, perfect. Good morning, everybody. Again, this time amplified. Thank you to the co-chairs, and welcome to the thank you to the committee members for having us here. Dr. Bastian and I are going to present simultaneously to provide an overview of school district size, implications for fiscal efficiency, and student outcomes. As a basic frame for the presentation, I'll be talking a little bit about findings from cost-based analysis. And Dr. Bastian will be talking a little bit about findings from performance-based analysis, both looking at the relationships between those factors with school district size. After we make some introductions, we'll talk a little bit about the historic context for school size, reviewing kind of a period of school consolidation in the past and reasons for those consolidations. Then I will be speaking about the cost literature. Dr. Bastian will be speaking about the production literature, and we'll have time for questions and discussion. By way of introduction, you already know my title. I'm Associate Professor of Leadership and Policy in the School of Education at UNC Chapel Hill. I am the co-author of a textbook on school finance. If you have any problems sleeping at night, Modern Education Finance and Policy is available on Amazon.com.
Is it available in Kindle?
It is not yet available in a Kindle edition, but we can make that happen. Part of my work as a school finance researcher is to examine issues of efficiency around states and districts. And to that end, I think pertinent to the work of the committee, I have written one article looking at school district efficiency in the state of Georgia, and will be presenting next week at a conference on measurements of the efficiency of charter schools in North Carolina.
Perfect. Go for it.
All right. So, yes, Kevin Bastian. I'm a senior research associate in the Department of Public Policy at UNC Chapel Hill, also at EPIC, the Education Policy Initiative at Carolina. My work focuses more, hence sort of this tag team approach, not on sort of costs and school finance, but on sort of teacher and school leader quality, inputs that might impact outcomes for students, like their test scores or other or absences or other things like that. And so I'll bring the sort of perspective of sort of education production functions, the idea of what sort of inputs or resources impact outcomes for kids. Do this. This is actually easier. Just do that. Yeah. All right. And so to start, before Eric, Dr. Haukagen talks about sort of the cost perspective, I wanted to just give a little bit of a historical context as it shapes some of this presentation. And I think, at least from the research on production or student outcomes, it actually shapes a little bit about what that research is, what research is available. So, of course, deconsolidation is sort of a much newer thing to think about, and much of our country's history is a process of consolidating schools and districts from, you know, almost 120,000 school districts in the 1940s to less than 15,000 in 2009, from, you know, from approximately 200,000 unique public schools in the 1940s to around 87,000 in 2009. So reasons districts and schools were consolidating were, of course, economies of scale, right? Trying to do things more efficiently from a cost perspective. There's also the idea of schools in particular, particularly high schools, but even districts in general, being able to provide a more rich and fuller educational curriculum if they were of a sufficient size. You could think about specializing teachers, certain labs for science, etc. And of course, I think suppose another reason for consolidation would be sort of in rural districts or other places, you know, fiscal concerns, or of course a history of desegregation. Concerns, of course, with consolidation, why it could theoretically or conceptually not be a good thing, is just the idea of kids or families sort of being lost at sea, so to speak. Just the idea that there might be less, in large districts or large schools, less opportunities for participation, less opportunities for heavy sort of or intensive relationships and investment in the school and in the district. Honestly, consolidation or school closure is still a pretty relevant topic in the country, particularly in rural locations. Arkansas, West Virginia, you know, it's come up in recent years where districts and schools are really small, and they've talked about, you know, consolidating districts, etc. So what does this mean for research? What it sort of means is, if we've spent most of our time as a country, and really been the 40s and 50s where most of the consolidation took place, there's very little examples of deconsolidation, right? There's not a lot we can look to from a research perspective and sort of say what happened after two districts, or a district split in two, or a district split in three, right? So that frames sort of the research we have available in some ways, and I'll talk more about that a little bit later, but that is sort of an important context to keep in mind. Yeah.
So before speaking a little bit about findings from the cost-based literature, I want to present something of what us academics would call a theoretical framework for how we understand the resource environment working around public education. This is drawn from Modern Education Finance and Policy, published in 2007, and basically articulates the fact that around school finance issues, as around many public policy issues, there are different values instantiated in policies, and that these values pull and tug at each other, that there's tension among these. As authors of the textbook, we posit four values within the school finance field, those being equity, efficiency, which is the topic of our talk today, liberty, both in terms of parental choice, but also in terms of subsidiarity of governmental units, and then adequacy or sufficiency of funding. I think it's important to foreground this visual before we begin talking about findings from the cost literature, because researchers in this area are obviously just pulling out one thread of this framework and trying to give it a lot of attention. But from a policy perspective, which is something else that I teach at UNC, we don't want to lose sight of the fact that this one value or idea of efficiency in a policy framework is being held in tension with other values as well. So when a researcher is conducting a cost study at the state level, what they're trying to do is understand the effect of different variables on the per pupil expenditure of, in many examples, a state, and trying to find factors that drive that per pupil expenditure either up or down. And what they do is they'll take that per pupil expenditure amount and analyze it relative to a host of other independent variables. These can be student composition variables, student performance variables, community variables, and also district size variables. So there's a lot of different pieces of that puzzle moving together to predict what moves cost up or down. And so what we're presenting is findings of studies that have done these cost analyses and then pulled out the variable of enrollment or district size and looked at what those findings are. To telegraph the point, the findings are not in alignment with each other and relatively scattered all over the map. That is to say, there is no real consensus about the relationship between district size and cost. And I want to speak to that in the next couple of slides. The overall finding, although this is not universal, but the overall consensus seems to be that district size operates on efficiency along a U-shaped curve. That is, districts are inefficient when they're very small. There's a sweet spot in the middle of the curve where districts are maximally efficient, and that efficiency sort of drops off as districts get increasingly larger. Just to hit some of the key findings that might be of interest. A 2002 review of the literature by Andrews, Duncan, and Yinger indicates, looking over a number of studies, that this U-shaped curve might have a turning point around the enrollment level of 15,000 students. That is to say, you would begin to see efficient operations diminish once the size of the district got over 15,000 students. A recent study working, it's not a peer-reviewed piece, but it was done for the General Assembly in Kansas, looking at reconfiguring their funding model by Lori Taylor, found that that threshold point was around 10,000 students. A couple of other pieces that didn't quite make it in the slides that I do want to note. A 2003 study and a 2006 study each looked at what we would call sort of larger size districts, that is, districts over 15,000. The 2003 study found very small inefficiencies as districts climbed over 15,000, and the 2006 study found relatively robust negative impacts of school size on efficiency. When I say negative, I just want to make sure I'm clear about what I'm talking about. The 2003 study found that as the districts got larger over 15,000, they became less efficient. The 2006 study indicates that as districts got over 15,000 students, they became more efficient. So again, not seeing a lot of consensus in the literature around what this size effect on efficiency would be. Other findings from the literature review that may be of interest to the committee, the hypothesis from Andrews, Duncan, and Yinger is that you still realize operational efficiencies of district size as districts get larger, but those gains are offset by transportation costs as the need to move students around across schools becomes higher. And that is one hypothesis as to what's wiping out the administrative efficiencies of larger sized districts. And I think another critical point to sit on for maybe a minute or so is that researchers are very interested in, and as of yet unable to really pinpoint, some really important interactions between the size of the district and the size of the schools within that district. That is to say, there's a relatively robust literature on school size, indicating that smaller schools can sometimes be better for student learning. I think Kevin's going to talk a little bit about some of those findings. But very little attention has been paid to the size of schools within smaller districts and within larger districts. That is to say, it may be the case that smaller districts seem to be more efficient in terms of producing student test scores because they contain smaller schools. And it's the school size effects that drive the finding, not the district size effect. So it's really still a live question for researchers if you deconsolidated a relatively large district but maintained relatively large school sizes, if you'd see the efficiency trade-offs that that researchers are talking about. A related and important finding is that school composition and school recomposition, as in creating new schools with new student bodies, can impact operational efficiencies within a district by the composition of those schools. So one of the things that we do know is that schools and districts with higher concentrations of higher need students have greater costs to meet the needs of those students in terms of an adequacy perspective. So as schools move towards reconfiguration, it's the composition of the schools and districts that could have an impact, and if not done thoughtfully, could actually wipe out any operational efficiencies gained, if indeed there would be any, through a deconsolidation move. Secondly, studies have found that the composition of special needs students in districts and schools is a drag on the efficient operation of those schools. I would think particularly in North Carolina, where special education funding is capped at a percentage across districts and locals carry the additional burden of meeting those needs, that sort of unfunded mandate can be a drag on efficiency. And what we see with this slide is that a lot of these findings and issues that arise out of potentially thinking about a deconsolidation framework are actually issues that are addressed or leveraged within state school finance mechanisms. So, for example, sparsity funding, density funding, more thoughtful special needs funding, and other types of tools within the school finance mechanism toolkit are often used to address issues that arise up that we're discussing in terms of school and district deconsolidation. Having presented what I think is sort of the generalized state of the field around findings from cost studies, I do want to present a couple of caveats and a couple of additional studies. One of the caveats is that until recently, studies have not been looking at metrics other than student performance, and that student performance metric was a percent proficient metric. As many of y'all in the room know, a lot of state data systems have moved to looking at value-added or growth modeling, that is trying to understand student learning instead of student proficiency levels. And I think there would be implications for how we understand the efficiency of districts if we were looking at a different outcome model in general. A second and related point that's actually a little more expansive is that if you're looking at proficiency or at growth, many of these studies are using student academic performance as the only indicator of what an efficiency relationship would be. So if you want to use the metaphor that I use in my classes sometimes, this is sort of a Coke machine metaphor. You put a dollar in and a can of Coke comes out. This is the basic input-output model that cost studies are using, and the output that they're using is student test scores. Some have argued across the political spectrum, right, coming from the left, which would be Anthony Roll at the University of Rhode Island, and from the right, Eric Hanischek at Stanford, that schools don't operate this way. They don't operate in what we would call a technical efficiency framework. Rather, schools and school organizations are pursuing multiple outcomes simultaneously. Legislators, as part of this process, create policies that ask schools to provide additional outcomes. For example, the health of the students, the safety of the students, the ability of the students to be good citizens. And some of that stuff might not be captured in a test score if it's a proficiency level or a growth score. So the idea behind that then is that schools are practicing what's called allocative efficiency. They're spending all of their resources to achieve a range of goals, and they're achieving those goals simultaneously. And that thinking about schools in more of this input-output model is really a little bit of a disadvantage, right? Schools pursue multiple goals simultaneously. There's uncertainty regarding the nature of what the mandates are going to be coming from policymakers, and schools are relatively immobile in the sense that they can't move offshore or relocate to a better place in which to pursue their goals.
May I interrupt you for a moment, sir? I want to ask a clarifying question that when you're talking about performance levels and not growth and performance, are we talking at this particular time about academic performance, or are we talking about the performance of the cost of operating the school system?
Very good. So when you're talking about this, thank you for the question. When we're talking about this relationship previous to the slide, we're looking at cost for academic performance as the input-output relationship.
Okay, so when we're talking about the growth in performance, we're talking about the growth in student academic performance. All right. Thank you.
And the point I'm inelegantly trying to make is that performance can be more broadly considered to include other types of outcomes rather than just academic outcomes.
So thank you.
Thank you for the question. To that end, a couple of studies that have been produced within this allocative framework, a 2016 review looking in Texas that found no relationship between efficiency as defined in the study and school district size. This was a study that was looking at the relative production efficiency of districts as comparing districts to each other rather than to a more kind of linear norm, and then a study in Georgia, which I conducted, which found that district size was unrelated to performance on either grade level tests or graduation rates, but that district size was positively associated with improved passing on state administered graduation tests. So in sum, I feel like I've tried to be true to the literature to present the confused nature of the literature from a cost function perspective, and we'll let Kevin talk a little bit about the production perspective.
Perfect. All right, thank you very much. And so I think that was really a nice segue, actually. So Dr. Houck started by, you know, having us think about sort of cost as the outcome, and the extent to which school district size or other inputs are sort of efficient or inefficient. As he was ending, though, he started to bleed over into exactly what, you know, I'll talk about more in depth, and that's just sort of this idea of how there's a whole other set of studies that come from something sort of called like the education production function literature that are really looking at student, you know, academic outcomes or absences or things like that as the outcome that's being predicted by certain inputs. You know, those inputs can be, you know, per pupil expenditures, characteristics of the students in the school or the socioeconomic status of the community, teachers, and then again, it could also be school or district size. So over several decades, starting, I think, really honestly, probably in the late 60s and 70s and moving onwards, there's been a lot of work, you know, in the education production function. I still use it, right? When I look at the effectiveness of teachers prepared through a certain route in North Carolina and a kid's test scores are the outcome, that's still sort of a education production function. Within a really large body of literature doing this, there's not a lot of explicit work on district size. There's more so on school size, but less so on district size. And sometimes when district size is sort of in a model, it's not a focal variable. People aren't really paying attention to it, right? Something else, it was being controlled for, but other things the researchers were really paying attention to. So like a few really broad comments before spending a few slides talking about the dozen or so studies that are out there. Yes, there's not really a sizable literature on LEA size. Most of the literature has looked at test performance, students' test scores. A key thing to note, and I'll come back to this, this is not individual student data. It's aggregated to the school level or even the district level in a lot of these analyses. And again, I'll sort of come back to that, but the fact that it's aggregated, I think, is worth noting. There's been a few studies that have looked at, you know, whether students are pursuing additional education beyond sort of compulsory education, average daily attendance rates at schools. One study that looked at how district size impacts the extent to which districts take up and make progress in implementing reforms. So those are some of the outcomes that are out there. When researchers try to look at the relationships between district size and a given outcome, like test scores, they typically operationalize district size in one of a few ways. You know, the most basic is simply the number of students enrolled overall in the LEA or enrolled in the school, if we're talking about school size. Sometimes the work done is on particular grade levels, basically because that's where the certain tests were available in the 80s or 90s when they were doing this research. And so they'd be looking at the you know, district size would be the number of third graders or the number of ninth graders in the district. Other researchers have taken sort of this continuous variable, which is district size, and chopped it up into different categories. So districts of, you know, less than 5,000 kids, districts from 5,000 to 10,000, et cetera. That's another way to sort of cut it up and look at the relationship with outcomes. And then finally, a few studies actually have operationalized district size by actually the number of schools in a district. So 10, 20, 50, 100, what have you. So those are sort of the different ways of doing it. Very few of the studies have sort of tried to really look for non-linear relationships well. And so that's something to sort of think about. Like if you're just looking at district size and it's just a single variable, it might be that like that U-shaped curve Eric was talking about for finance, where you're inefficient and then you're efficient and then you're sort of inefficient again. It really sort of might be that sort of a similar relationship with numbers. And so just a single variable for the number of kids in the district might not capture that. And then lastly, sort of state context. Much of the work on LEA size has taken place in a relatively small number of states. Several studies were done in California, several in New Jersey, several in Texas. Then there's been sort of a few rural states sort of represented, West Virginia, Alaska, a little bit in Alabama, a little bit in Georgia. So that's sort of the general framework of sort of where this has taken place, what researchers are looking at, and how they're thinking about operationalizing district size. And before actually talking about some of the studies and some of the findings, I would sort of, at the outset, frame them in a similar way, and actually a good review of the literature published about 15 years ago sort of made the statement that the existing evidence is somewhat mixed in terms of what it shows for district size and outcomes. But several studies do show that smaller LEAs are associated with what you might call desired outcomes for kids. So for instance, a study of Texas high schools showed that there were higher average daily attendance rates when there were fewer schools in the district. That's one where they operationalized district size by the number of schools. Although I would note that that study also controlled for school size and like pupil-teacher ratios, and those had larger impacts on average daily attendance rates than the number of schools in the district. Some work in California has shown higher school level achievement in elementary and middle schools with smaller districts. Work in New Jersey, several studies in New Jersey have shown higher school level achievement in grades 3, 6, and 9, and higher school level achievement and higher test passing rates in New Jersey high schools with fewer schools in the district. I'll note that last study, rather interestingly, controlled for both the number of schools in the district and the number of enrolled students. So like they operationalized district size in both ways simultaneously. The number of students in the district didn't matter. It was the number of schools in that case. So there's another set of studies where overall there's no real relationship between district size and whatever outcome we're looking at, like student achievement, let's say. But there's sort of an interaction effect, by which I mean as the SES of the district or the community in which the district is in increases, the effect of LEA size on student achievement goes from negative to positive. So put more simply, in affluent districts or communities, large district size was beneficial. In impoverished communities or districts, large district size actually had a negative result. And so there's been several studies starting in the late 80s in California, and then sort of replicated in West Virginia, replicated again sort of in Georgia and Washington State, where there's some evidence there of sort of not a overall impact of district size, but it mattered based on sort of the composition of the district. And of course, just like the sort of the school finance literature on efficiency, there's a set of studies where district size is good. Larger districts are doing better. Larger LEAs in Texas had higher eighth grade science scores. One of the only studies that has used student level data, and I'll come back and talk about that briefly in a second, was actually done in not in the United States, but in Denmark. And they were following 9 birth cohorts of individuals, of kids, into completing their probability of completing sort of education post compulsory education in Denmark. And there they actually found that students coming from larger municipalities were more likely to go on and complete higher education, either vocational or university. As Dr. Haukes found, LEA size was positively associated with improved passing rates on state-administered tests in Georgia. And then rather interestingly, a study from the late 90s was showing that larger districts and schools in larger districts reported greater progress in implementing standards-based reform. And if we go back 2 decades now, that was sort of, you know, before accountability, before teacher evaluation, that was the big sort of policy issue, state and national levels, was sort of standards, common standards, assessments, etc. And they were finding that larger districts, largely given their capacity, were better able to make progress on implementing needed changes for standards-based reform.
Could I ask a question? When you say Denmark, you're not referring to a section of some state, but we're talking about a Scandinavian country.
We are talking about a Scandinavian country. Yeah.
Were there controls for cultural differences between Denmark and the U.S.?
Well, I think there was no controls for that in the sense that you know, the author, the researcher, wasn't trying to make an explicit comparison between Denmark and the U.S. It was just work using actually a very nice data set there compared to some of the work that's done that was able to show size effects.
Okay, thank you.
But you should question differences in samples. That's worth doing. So, I mentioned, you know, at the outset that much like the finance work, there's a mixed bag here. And so I wanted to try to interpret sort of a little bit where I think this sits. Much of these studies were either done in the 80s or 90s or using data from the 1980s and 1990s. So 2 points there. You know, one, 20 to 30 years ago, obviously some things should certainly change. And two, I'll talk about this a little bit more, but administrative data sets have changed drastically through policies in southern states, like here in North Carolina, where we were a pioneer of having end of grade and end of course tests, do No Child Left Behind, etc. You know, education research and looking at student achievement has vastly changed over those several decades. Secondly, many of these studies are not controlling for much in terms of how does size, district size, predict the given outcome they're looking at. And so I think there's real questions about the extent to which they're isolating size as impacting whatever outcome they're looking at versus other things they're not controlling for. Related to that second point is just this idea of, again, there's very few studies. Matter of fact, the only study that I've cited here that used student level data was actually the study in Denmark. Very few studies have used student level data at this point. It's almost always aggregated to the school or district levels, which means there's a lot of variation that's not really being explored from a research perspective that you'd want to see explored. As Dr. Hauck mentioned, from a finance perspective, there's also been really only one study that I saw that paid attention to this idea of the interaction effects between district and school size, right? Like, you could have small districts with small schools, small districts with larger schools, vice versa. And there is a much more robust literature on school size, which does tend to suggest that, again, there's certain thresholds, but smaller schools would be performing better. And so I think there's trade-offs and there's you know, there's interactions to be thinking about there that haven't necessarily been well teased out in the work. Much like this idea of sort of allocative ideas from the cost perspective, is also this idea in the production perspective that much of the work focusing on district size and outcomes is static in the sense that often it's using 1 year of data and it's looking at a proficiency level or achievement level rather than growth, which means it's hard to say what in an environment where we care much more and we're much more attuned over the last several decades from a research perspective about student growth and measuring it, we don't really have a picture of the relationship between district size and growth. And lastly, going back to one of the first points we made about sort of the history of consolidation, the fact that so few districts have actually sort of split up means there's the lack of sort of natural experiments to study. If some of the studies I talked about were from a perspective where districts were splitting apart and you were looking at what happened to students in those districts, you would feel stronger about the inferences you can make from that, you would feel were more strongly supported than some inferences you might want to be able to make from the current extent of the literature and the research. So, you know, we talked and sort of came up with a few combined conclusions that I think actually sort of hold across both the cost and the outcomes perspective. And then, you know, after that, we're welcome to answer questions, talk, etc. And then, I think what's really key here is regardless of researchers of different perspectives, researchers who have come to different conclusions about size as you read it, they'll still, many of them will still sort of say there's no optimal size, right? There's no one size fits all. It can differ, and it can differ across outcomes, groups of students, as we talked about, and values, as we were talking about at the beginning. It's not just efficiency, right? You know, as we've thought about it, in the North Carolina context, really large districts like Charlotte or Wake would likely need to be divided not just once, but sort of many times to capture sort of potential benefits, you know, for instance, like an efficiency benefit. If the sweet spot is, you know, 10 or 15,000 students, that's a lot of more cutting up. And even if there's a, even if there is sort of a relationship between district size and student outcomes, you know, cutting a large district in like that in two would still leave very large districts, honestly. And there's also sort of questions about, again, school size. There still may be large schools, of course, within a smaller LEA unit. And again, there is more robust and consistent relationship about school size and outcomes. Of course, there's the distribution questions. You know, of course, which portions of any LEA would form a new LEA, right? Again, as I come back to thinking about the production perspective and outcomes, so there, I would say there's some evidence related to LEA size, but I think there's a real concern as to whether it, at this point, would it warrant a consequential decision, right, to be made about it. And I do think there's opportunities. This really hasn't been revisited in quite some time. Much of what's been done was in the 80s, the 90s, early 2000s for the most part. I mean, I do think there's opportunities to revisit this in North Carolina and other places where there's really, you know, outstanding data sets that could be brought to bear. So I think with that, we will stop formally and just open up.
All right, gentlemen, thank you for taking on a very difficult topic, particularly with unclear data sets. Are there questions for the presenters? Representative Stevens.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your presentation. The one thing that did seem to consistently come out in your presentation is that smaller schools perform better. Schools, not LEAs, but smaller schools perform better. What is your definition of a smaller school?
I believe some of the work around small schools had set high schools sort of between 600 and 900, but I would want to sort of go back and look at that again. That wasn't really a focus as I thought about today. Obviously, sort of, if you think about this from a research sort of perspective and from sort of a policy perspective as well, I think many of us are probably familiar, you know, North Carolina being a great example. The Gates Foundation put a lot of money into North Carolina in, I guess, the 90s and the 2000s for like schools within schools and high schools. And that was built around this notion of small might be better. I don't think that necessarily had as much of the positive outcomes they were hoping for. But yes, I would agree in the sense that the literature is more consistent and more robust in terms of number of studies that school size has more of a relationship.
Follow up.
Okay. So when you say also high school, are you talking 8 through 12, 9 through 12? I mean, how many grades in that number of kids?
Typically 9 through 12, but I think, you know, there's certainly different configurations.
Follow up. Senator Waddell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, presenters. As I listened to your presentation and looked at the slides, and your conclusions here states that no optimal size may differ based on outcome, group, and value. So over and over, as you looked at Texas, as you looked at California, and gave information there, what you tend to say is there is nothing conclusive as to size and the relationship about finances and student achievement. Is that correct? That's what I heard you say.
Yes, I think it's fair to say that there are studies. I'm going to speak from the outcomes perspective, and you can certainly speak from the cost perspective again. I mean, there are studies, I think, to the extent that they lean one way or the other, more seem to find some positive results for smaller districts. But I would, at this point, have some hesitations about sort of, again, the data that was used. And it's not because it wasn't good research. It was, a lot of this was done with the best data they had, right? But aggregated data, not looking at growth at all, et cetera, not controlling for things that might be actually explaining the results they're getting. So it's not as if there isn't results, but I would sort of say that the evidence doesn't indicate that size is necessarily the mechanism driving those results. If hopefully that conveys it well.
Thank you. Follow up.
Did you have a follow up?
Oh no, you had something else to say.
I was going to second that general perspective from the cost study perspective. I think the consensus around cost and district size is from older studies, and as we begin to look in more subtle ways at this question, the more recent studies, you see wider variations in finding and less of a consensus.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Waddell, were you finished?
No.
Okay.
Thank you. I was looking also at your historical perspective where you talked about rich curriculum and many things were lost sometimes when you looked at size and when you compare the small size as well as the large size. But I was wondering also if you had taken a look, an in-depth look about North Carolina. You mentioned Wake and Mecklenburg, any of the other systems in North Carolina when you looked at consolidation and size. Those were the two that you mentioned.
Right. And you know, I think to be fair, our focus on Wake and Charlotte have been both the largest districts in the state and sort of our own anecdotal reading of sort of the districts that this committee has been sort of perhaps most interested in. And perhaps that's a wrong reading of that situation, but that's where some of that, I think, is focused on. But I mean, obviously, there's many other large districts in North Carolina as well. But there hasn't really been, to your sort of question about looking specifically at Wake and CMS, I mean, none of the research, you know, I was presenting, nor you, were really focused or had occurred in North Carolina as it comes to district size. So.
Okay. Follow up? Senator Waddell, follow up?
No, not at this time, perhaps later.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So as I listened, I was struck by the 15,000 number. And so in your description of a U-shaped efficiency curve that breaks somewhere, I think you were saying breaks somewhere at that range. And what I guess it makes me curious is, as you point out, systems like Wake and Mecklenburg would have to be split many times to get anywhere near that number. But I'm curious whether, you know, there are, as in Wake and Mecklenburg, we heard from Ms. McGraw at our last meeting about, I think it was Clark County, Nevada, that had a much, much larger system even than either of those, if I recall correctly. Mm-hmm. Have those systems, large urban systems, been studied? And what is the, if they're included in the data that makes out the U-curve, what does the U-curve look like at that much, much larger size?
Yeah. Thank you for the question. So, No, it is the short answer. I was trying to come back around, just looking through my notes in preparation for this. There were a couple of studies in Texas that broke district size out into categories, and that was the only study that was basically had an isolated variable that looked at very large districts. And very large was still over 15,000. Right, so orders of magnitude less than a WAKE or a CMS, and that was where a 2003 study found that size increased inefficiency, and a 2006 study found the opposite. So you have basically four studies, two on one side, two on the other, that were using that method of categorizing district size.
Follow up, Senator Pate.
Thank you. An interesting presentation. I wonder, though, if you are limiting your studies to just schools in the United States, public schools, private schools, how about foreign countries? Their education goes on all the way around the world, of course.
Certainly does. No, in the sense that, if you go onto a library or an online engine to look at research, like a Google Scholar or other things like that, honestly, there is little work on two points, I suppose. First, to your question, certainly no. If studies, I talked about the study from Denmark, had others sort of been germane, I would have included them. But secondly, there really is little work on district size over the last decade or so. Much of what I talked about, much of what's really out there is, again, from the 80s, 90s, and sort of early 2000s.
Follow up.
Thank you. Thank you. So that is, it's basically then just an economic exercise, looking at these various district sizes. Is that correct or incorrect?
I would say the framework for analysis that I was presenting comes from an economics framework, definitely.
And honestly, you mentioned Eric Kanyushek, a famous researcher at Stanford. He, along with some others, were sort of pioneers in the 70s and 80s in sort of what would become value-added modeling, which I think you might have heard about, how to like calculate the quality of a school or a teacher, right? Thinking about it from the production perspective. I mean, the production is obviously a business perspective where you have an output and you have inputs to try to get there. That evolved or was adapted for education, where you have an output like kids' test scores and you have a set of inputs or resources like school size or expenditures to help predict it and understand it. So I would say yes, it is sort of an economic framework in looking at this.
Follow up.
Just from historical values, a few years back, I don't know exactly how many it was, Burroughs Wellcome Foundation was very active in getting us out of North Carolina and going into foreign countries and looking at their school systems and that sort of thing. I was lucky enough to take a couple of trips. I think Representative Gill was on one of them at least, and maybe perhaps some other people, but those were very informative observations that we were able to make firsthand, and I'm not sure but what we might be able to gain from things like that again.
Thank you, Senator. There was one issue that was raised with discussion of the caps on special needs students, and I asked, I'd like for staff to address that, because that may be new information for some members of the committee.
And I will defer to the FISC colleagues if they want to add anything, but we did confirm it is currently 12.75% is the cap for special education funding for LEAs.
So if there is additional money needed within an LEA, that falls to the county to provide it, or else the LEAs to do without it?
And again, I'll defer to my fiscal colleagues, but yeah, that is the extent of the state funding for students with disabilities.
Yes, Mr. Moore.
Yes, Eric Moore, Fiscal Research. That mostly is true. They can tap into any other state funding that's unallowable use for. There is also a Children with Special Needs Contingency Reserve in case they have students with particularly high cost requirements to them. Okay. They can apply to the state and receive an additional allocation to help cover the cost of that student.
All right. Senator Bishop.
Mr. Chairman, I'm wondering, in follow-up to that, to Ms. McGraw's point and the other information from this fiscal research, how many counties are upside down on that? In other words, is the...
Understood.
Yeah.
Mr. Moore, do we have a sense of how many counties are upside down or requiring additional funds locally?
Give me just 1 minute and I'll look that up.
All right. Thank you. We'll come back to you. I notice that Mary McCray, who is chairman of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Board of Education, is in attendance. Madam Chair, would you care to tell me who you have with you today? You will never have to prove your courage in any other way again. Are there other school boards in attendance? All right. Representative Malone, would you like to identify the members of your local board? Yeah, here.
Sure.
Yeah.
For a moment.
Yeah, you're
sure.
Right. How about that, huh? We have a number of Wake County board members present today. We have Monica Johnson Hostler as the chair. If you would stand, please. Thank you. Bill Fletcher's over here. I saw Bill. Roxy Cash. Hi, Roxy. Kathy Harkenstein. Can you say it for me, please? Oh, my. Harkenstein. Very good. And Lindsay Mahaffey. Hi, Lindsay. And, of course, we have Superintendent Del Burns. He's interim superintendent. Superintendent Burns, nice seeing you again. And then we have a staff member, Marvin Connolly. It's nice seeing you again, sir. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Mr. Moore is recognized.
Yes, sir. There are currently 60 school districts above the 12.75% cap on their number of EC students identified. But I will caution to contemplate how the money is to be used to support the students. It really depends on what kind of program the school districts are offering, what kind of needs the students have, to say whether a district, whether above or below the cap, has sufficient funding just from a state allocation to provide support for those students. It's really about the kind of program they're offering. The cap just puts a ceiling on how much the state is willing to contribute as a per student kind of allocation rather than covering a percentage of the cost of serving that student.
All right. Thank you, sir. Senator Bishop.
I'd be interested in a copy of that list if there's a list of 60 counties being included.
Right. Mr. Moore, if you would make that available to the committee clerks, that'll be distributed to all members of the committee and placed on the website. Representative Stevens.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I wanted to ask the question. He said 60 districts. Does he mean 60 LEAs or does he mean, okay, 60 LEAs out of 115? Wow.
Yes. A significant number. A little outside of our area, but we're following the data wherever it leads. Just a couple of comments from the chairman's point. I've noticed that a lot of the data you have is aggregated data, and we really don't have good measurements on impact at the student level to the same extent. I thought I heard you say it in one of the studies, it showed that there was positive growth as the school system got larger if it was wealthy, but more negative things that as a school system got larger if it were poor. Did I hear that correctly?
That's correct.
Okay. And we have a sense that there may be more of a positive effect from smaller schools than smaller LEAs, but we really don't have good data.
Yeah, I think I would say a couple of things. First, yes, there's been several studies replicated, et cetera, that looked at sort of that interaction between district size and SES of the district or community. And overall, there was no relationship. But again, like they did sort of find that in affluent districts, there was a positive relationship and a negative. But with the caveat that most of those studies had achievement as the outcome, they controlled for the SES of the district. They controlled for the size of the district, and they interacted the two, which is to say they didn't really control for much. And so I'd have questions still about really whether it was the size. It might be the size, but I would have questions about what it was.
Thank you, sir, because as I was listening to these and going through, and there were times that I was saying, yeah, that support's breaking up, then maybe it doesn't. And I think in the final analysis, there's not enough. I thought it was maybe a little more towards breakup, but not enough for anybody to claim victory. And what we really know is we know enough to know that we don't really know. Is that a fair statement?
I think so. I mean, I think, and your comment about the aggregated data, again, it's not to say that the research done in 1987 or 1991 was not well done. It's to say that in the world, in the big data world we live in now, which is not just education, right? Mm-hmm. There's a lot more data that if those people were doing that study now, it would look different.
Thank you, gentlemen. Yes, sir.
To add to the point, you know, these breakups aren't free. The deconsolidation itself carries a cost that needs to be balanced against whatever savings there might be long run, right? That's a fiscal equation that you can do. There aren't any examples of, I think, the types of work that the committee is studying, but there have been a couple of places recently that have come in the news around this. One is Memphis, Shelby County, Tennessee. And one is Gardendale in Alabama.
We discussed that at length at our last session. I would say to you, in my eighth year in this building, nothing is free. And when somebody says it's free, they mean it's free of additional cost to you, but somebody else is paying for it. So I appreciate your caution, but yeah, we've got that in mind.
You're invited.
Representative Stevens.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm going to go to the couple of slides that you didn't really talk about here. And the efficient production of AMOs, what are each of your dots?
We did not discuss this. I wasn't sure where the conversation would take us. We have not made this part of our presentation. But this is the type of analysis that we conducted in my team conducted in Georgia using something called a quadriform analysis. Looking at sort of residual efficiency once you've accounted for a lot of the big cost drivers and trying to understand within a state where LEAs are able to maximize their context, that is, seem to be doing much better than other LEAs, and that's what the scatter plot is. So this is 2015, looking at LEAs in North Carolina, and trying to understand the relationship between funding and percentage of AMOs achieved in that year. I think it would be like a different presentation.
Certainly. Follow up. So you're saying each of these dots represents an LEA in North Carolina.
That's correct.
And some of them are doing with low input, getting high output. Some of them with high output are getting high output.
Yeah.
Some of them with high input are getting low input. It may be more effective to drill down to some of these schools to see what they're doing right, or these LEAs to see what they're doing right or what they're doing wrong.
Yeah, and also unstated in there is that some of these districts are held harmless. That is to say that they're so close to the lines that we don't feel comfortable making a determination as to what category they fall into. I would say that this would fall into also to the category of Dr. Bastian's comments about what additional studies might look like moving forward to try to understand with a little more depth and subtlety what LEA performance looks like in North Carolina.
Representative Gill.
Thank you, Chairman. Is the output for this graph based on test scores?
This is the percentage of annual measurable objectives met. Then you can run parallel analysis that looks at percent proficient. You can plug almost any outcome measure that you desire into this model and run it forward to produce a different scatter plot.
Follow up. Representative Bradford.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you to the presenters. I mean, obviously, we have data here, you know, in your combined conclusions talks about this being from the 80s and 90s. I know distribution of, if you did a deconsolidation, how do you do that? Can you comment on the pros or cons or negatives or positives, if any, regarding the local representation, meaning if there was a deconsolidation, is there data out there that supports, good or bad? I think of Dallas. Dallas at one point had decided dividing into four quadrants. And part of the reasoning was there would be better representation at the school board level of communities in those quadrants than perhaps a larger board. Is there any data to support something like that? And, you know, good or bad, I didn't see anything or anything in the report and was just curious if that was something that crossed your radar.
I don't know. I can't speak to it from the data perspective, but I can speak to it from the conceptual, the theoretical perspective, right? Like, we had that slide about sort of at the front, the history of consolidation. You know, like, a concern with consolidation was just this idea of all of a sudden, you know, I called it lost at sea, but you have bigger districts, bigger schools, kids are less connected, less, perhaps less opportunities for participation. That's not necessarily obviously a given, but sort of that relationship, which I think you're speaking to as well. Like, there's more opportunities for representation in different forms. So participation or sort of emotional investment is sort of one of the conceptual lenses someone would bring to sort of the study of, about why size might be bad, right?
Follow-up, Mr. Chairman.
Follow-up.
So, you know, obviously, urban America is growing leaps and bounds, population explosions going on, and really that's what this is about, urban areas that are growing, and how do you get a handle on these school districts? So, are you aware of any active studies or any active urban centers that are going through a deconsolidation, and is that being studied?
I'm not, no, I am. Well, Memphis, I suppose.
Yeah, Memphis, Shelby County. Yeah, right. So we made reference to Shelby County, which was a DRE-D consolidation. And I think there are folks in Tennessee who are researching that, but that's preliminary. And I think as a result of attention with the Gardendale situation, there are researchers who are paying attention to that because that was a slow motion deconsolidation of Jefferson County, Alabama, right? Gardendale was the 11th district to petition to leave that. That area, and so you have a history of 10 other districts doing it, and I think folks are starting to pay attention to that as well.
And the only thing I'd say about Memphis and Shelby County also, if you start to think about it from a research perspective, was also a place where there was a lot of innovative school districts, other things going on in Memphis and Shelby County that would not preclude it being looked at, but that context would be important when you'd be thinking about what happened there.
All right. Want to talk first, Shelby Armentrout, who is the House Educational Policy Advisor, was here. I apologize. The tape on the right side of my head blocked my vision of you. You should have been introduced at the beginning. For our next meeting, we're going to gentlemen, thank you. We'll let you go at this point. You've escaped. Delving a little more into, you know, the two things we're most interested in, efficiency but also effectiveness, we've issued some invitations to specific programs in schools around the state, and staff is going to tell us who we heard back from that's willing to do it that we asked to present. And that's as of today.
Thank you, Chairman Brawley. So far, we have the following school systems that are going to be coming to speak at the next meeting. Sugar Creek Charter School from the Mecklenburg area will be coming. CMS will be coming to talk about the Project Lift initiative. Community High School, which is the alternative high school for Buncombe County, will be presenting. I may not pronounce this quite correctly. Contanea Savannah K-8 STEM School in Lenore County will be coming, and Surrey County will be doing a presentation on their next generation high schools.
Let's see, we had one advance that from whom we've not heard that we may have, and Elkin had an innovative program, but they're on spring break and everybody's at the beach. So at this point, we can do that. Representative Gill.
I just want to ask a question. I'm kind of curious. It seems like all of the schools that have been invited next week are small schools and not necessarily districts. Is there any I thought he was only talking about, if I'm not mistaken, I thought you said there were a presentation by CMS about a program that they have within that school.
That is correct. Okay. This is not presentations on schools by the school systems on for them to come in and tell us how great they're doing. What we're looking at is innovative programs that are addressing specific needs of specific populations. In fact, the Project Lift is one of the things. I think the Gates Foundation may have been involved in that or not. Mary, can you help me? But what they've essentially done is taken the West Charlotte High School and its feeder zone and bundle some services around it and paying extra attention to the students within that area, and are having some very dramatic results. And to the extent that that's an improvement in educational outcomes, that's relevant to our discussion. The others, what we actually got was a list of quite a few programs that were submitted, I believe, by Ms. Winter with the School Boards Association. And I went through them and consulted with staff, and we looked for people that had presentations that might add value into how do you better achieve educational outcomes. And this was not related to size of anything. It was related to, are they doing something good that might be worth replicating around the state? So it was not based on size. It was based on what are they doing that's different that appears to be working.
Oh, I just didn't see the connection between the presentation of these innovative programs as it relates to the vision of local school administrative units. I guess I've not made the, well, maybe I'm not clear on why the committee, what the function of the committee is. That may be my part of the confusion.
Perhaps that's a long discussion you and I should have.
Okay.
Apart from this. Okay. Representative Stevens.
Well, Mr. Chair, as you were saying it, I was thinking, even along what you said earlier, that perhaps this may be some alternatives to dividing school districts, is looking if there are additional programs that might benefit some of these larger divisions.
That's a good way of saying it. All right. Yeah, thank you. Further discussion, further debate? Hearing none, the meeting is adjourned.
I gave you the list of gifts.